From the Lend Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 9th day of January 2025. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. We're in our 40th year, 10,000 episodes, 30,000 interviews here on the Closing Market Report, including many with Matt Bennett of AgMarket.net. He'll come up to tell us a bit about what happened in the commodity markets today. I'll provide you with some reflections on President Jimmy Carter, and then as we close out our time together, we'll take up the weather forecast too. We'll do that with Mike Tenor on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
March corn for the day settled at $4.56¾, 2¾ higher. The May at $4.64¼, up 2¼. And December futures, that's the new crop, up a penny and a half at $4.46½. March beans, $9.96¾, up 2¼. The May at $10.08¼, up 2¼. And the November new crop at $10.10, a penny higher for the day. Bean meal down $1.70. The bean oil, 79¢ higher. Soft red winter wheat down 4¢ at $5.32¼ in the March. The hard red March at $5.48, down 2¼ on the afternoon. Live cattle futures at $198, $4.38 higher, rather $4.30 higher for the day. Feeders at $268.72½, up $3.75, and lean hogs at $82.15, $2.67½ higher. Matt Bennett is now here from AgMarket.net. Hi, Matt. Thank you much for being with us. You're on the road. It's winter meeting season. You were in where in southern Illinois this morning?
I was down at Wren Lake College for Farm Credit Services and did a meeting down there for them. They'd had an ice storm more so than a snowstorm, so their attendance was down a little, but several people made it out. It was a pretty good crowd. And then I'm going from there up to Iowa. I got Market to Market tomorrow.
All right. So on Market to Market, folks can watch that on our home station, WILL Channel 12, on Sunday. They'll get to see you. Thanks much for taking some time with us today. What do you hear about the markets, and what's your view of tomorrow's USDA report?
Yeah, I mean, today, you know, you got a little bounce in here. I think there's probably some position evening. You know, we're watching this Argentina forecast about every 6 hours, kind of like we would a U.S. forecast. Now, they're not at crunch time, so to speak, but people are watching those two-week forecasts pretty close. So this morning, it looked like a little more moisture. It didn't get any wetter at noon. In fact, maybe a little drier, depending on which model you looked at. Of course, we closed at noon, but I do think a lot of folks we're covering short positions that's been established lately, because clearly the market's been kind of in a sideways to lower tone. So as far as the report goes, I could see a trim on yield as possible, both corn and beans. I still think that dry August might hang around a little bit as far as trying to figure out the size of that crop. But Todd, I guess I just really struggle to find a way to get friendly, you know, unless it's a massive cut. And I don't think that's in store. It sure seems to us that most of your end users feel pretty comfortable with their coverage right now. It tells me there's still a lot of corn out here, so it's a big crop. But I could see a bullish report tomorrow producing, you know, potentially a negated version as far as what people react to it like. So I'm not super bullish or friendly at all unless we can get some South American weather to give us a boost.
So short-term friendly, and then long-term, unless there's a weather issue, there'll be a problem going into March? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
I'm praying that we rally a little, Todd, is what I'm doing. And if we do, I think we need to respect that rally. Tomorrow, Todd, I think you know it as well as anyone. There's just no way to know tomorrow. I mean, they could drop stocks. Heck, they could raise stocks. I mean, I don't think that will happen. Disappearance had to have been just phenomenal in the first marketing year quarter, especially for corn. And so, you know, I do think we've used a lot of corn. Demands looked awful good. But, you know, when you look at this world stock situation on soybeans, it's kind of an anchor on the entire market, whether you're talking corn or beans. So, you know, I think that a rally should be respected. I hope we get one, but it's awfully hard to know whether we will or not.
November, December, really good for ethanol. Actually, a bunch of record weeks in there, I suppose. You've been watching that one closely as it concerns consumption.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt consumption has been just phenomenal. I think the problem, of course, whenever you get into a great demand type talk, now you're going to start talking about acreage. And whenever it gets over to corn, you know, as we talked about on Commodity Week last week, you're looking at some healthy numbers. And so if you tack big acres onto even like a 1/6 carry, you've got to think that that's going to make it a real headwind for the market to rally. But yes, consumption has been fantastic.
As it relates to the grain stocks, do you think that the livestock number, which will be the feed and residual figure for WASDE, and partially the grain stocks as well, do you think those numbers have been big enough to really chew through feed in a dramatic way in the first quarter?
Not necessarily, but the feed and residual usage, as you know, Todd, sometimes that gets pretty creative in how they use that particular line item. So my personal opinion is if feed and residual usage would go up, it's got very little to do with feed. I tell you right now, with the corn market where it's at and wheat where it's at, there's a lot of folks talking about starting to introduce maybe some wheat into feed rations, especially if corn would move any higher at all. So I can't imagine that on the balance sheet, they're going to end up adjusting feed and residual usage higher unless they've made a mistake in a previous report. So I agree with you. I don't see any reason to really raise that thing.
You and I both spent a great deal of time with Darrell Good over the years. He would tell you, I know, that the reports tomorrow will set the tone for the next 3 months. What have you learned from him that tells you about what that tone, how to follow that tone once it is set and we know what the reports say?
Yeah, I think whenever it boils right down to it, that's the final number, of course. We know what the stocks number, the carryout is for old crop. Now we're going to start looking at new crop. To me, if we would get that thing down to 1/6 or below, you know, potentially that gives you a supportive type feel. I'm not saying it's bullish, but at least supportive. So this January report, you know, it does create lots of volatility, and there's good reason for it. And it's just what you stated, is that a lot of times you'll see this January report kind of change the tone somewhat. Right now, the tone has been a little more of a supportive tone over the last. I think we got to be respectful of the fact that we've already gained a lot. So maybe we don't get super bulled up. If you get a bullish report tomorrow, I see it as a really good opportunity to do some catch up as far as old crop goes, new crop goes, you name it.
All right. Hey, thanks much. Safe travels the rest of the way to Des Moines to do market to market. We'll be watching for you on Channel 12 this Sunday morning at 11:30 a.m.
Oh, absolutely, Todd. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Matt Bennett is with agmarket.net. I'll take some time today to remember former President Jimmy Carter. As it happens, he's one of my personal heroes. I was in grade school when he was the President of the United States. I suppose the late 1970s era had a lasting impact upon me. Had I been able to vote in 1980, I'd have voted for Ronald Reagan. I did so in 1984. Still, in 1978, I gave a speech at my 8th grade graduation. I was valedictorian. It was a class of just 10 students, and it was the last time my grades led the day. In that speech, I spoke, but did not rail, against smoking and noise pollution. Those are two things I still find terribly annoying. I find solitude in silence, or maybe better said, the sounds of nature. I remember thinking the same thing when visiting a construction site in India. There were no engines. The quiet of the work site was profound to me. This is all in reference to Jimmy Carter's profound but quiet nature. Now, I don't like conflict, and based simply on the way he spoke, neither did he. But he cared deeply about people and the planet. I met him once in St. Louis at the Donald Danforth Plant Sciences Center. The University of Illinois had just joined the consortium supporting the research that happens there. Carter gave a speech that included remarks on the developing world of genetically modified organisms, particularly plants. I think you'll find this portion of the post-keynote address press briefing interesting.
Well, I'll just say in opening that I'm delighted to be here at what I consider to be a momentous and historic occasion for all those throughout the globe who are interested in food and clothing and shelter, which I think would probably include everybody, even news reporters. And so if you have questions to ask, I'll be glad to answer them.
The first question asked by a reporter wanted to know if President Carter would expand on the comments he made during his speech related to the lobbying efforts against GMOs.
Yeah, in 1972 in Rio de Janeiro, it was mandated that at the end of a certain period of time, about 5 years, that all those who've ratified the treaty to protect the environment, and that at this time includes 172 nations, by the way, not including the United States of America, that they would come out with an international agreement on how to handle matters that might reflect adversely on the environment. There are some misguided and ill-advised people who have set upon a crusade to prevent any sort of genetically enhanced organisms from coming into a country. And what they are trying to do is to make it mandatory for a government of any country, say Ghana, to have to pass a law or written permission for any of those kinds of organisms to be brought into the country, which would preclude, if carried out the way they envision it now, any sort of chemical fertilizers, any sort of herbicides, any sort of insecticides, any sort of genetically enhanced seed that might be resistant to weeds or to the attack of insects, or that might be highly productive. I'm sure, very sincere people, but we've faced them all over Africa, and particularly in the crusade against the basic things that all of us have taken for granted since birth, and that is just the simple use of chemical fertilizers. We primarily use in those countries triple superphosphate and urea, and they have a crusade against the use of even chemical fertilizers. But there should be restraints placed on it, and that's one. I made one very brief comment in my talk. I was trying to keep it as simple as I could. In that, whenever Monsanto or American Home Products or other major corporations evolve these genetically improved mechanisms, either an organism or a chemical, they would be tested first among the hundreds of thousands or millions of American farmers and American consumers, who are protected, as you know, by the FDA and by other very carefully contrived laws. And it would probably, almost inevitably, only be after then that these fully tested and approved improvements would be introduced into a broad area of say, Africa or Asia. So you've got that built-in insurance policy. But it's hard to exaggerate the fervency of these people who are against any sort of genetically improved plants or chemicals.
The first genetically modified crops were introduced on the farm in 1995, and by the time this speech was made by President Carter, 80% of the soybeans in the United States were genetically altered to resist glyphosate or Roundup. The next question followed up on that point, wanting to know if there were any voices in the United States that were deploring GMOs.
Well, yes, they are prevalent here. In fact, I happen to be a very strong and dedicated environmentalist myself, and I have arguments with them sometimes. And I try to describe to them some points that I made in my talk, that we could not have made a living on our farm had we not used pesticides against weeds and insects in the growing of corn, for corn rootworm, and for soybeans, and for cotton, peanuts, everything that we grow. We couldn't have done it. And obviously, genetically improved, say, Bermuda grasses are now, you know, a basis for forage for our cattle. There's nothing artificial about it. In our programs in Ghana, I don't know if Dr. Bullock is here or not, but the Dr. Bullock, who's a Nobel Peace Prize winner for the Green Revolution, we just introduce basic and very simple things. We don't mechanize at all. Quite often is no animal husbandry involved, not even an oxen on the farm. The farms are too small. All of the work is done by human beings, quite often women, who do the manual labor and cultivation and so forth. And they, without using improved strains, mostly open-pollinated corn, the planting of them in contour rows, the fertilization, just to maintain the fertility of the soil as it produces repetitive crops, is the only thing that prevents slash and burn, where you just used a 2-acre field, and then next year you got to go to a different 2 acres. This is very destructive environmentally, the slash and burn technique that's used quite often in the world. So there are Americans who feel very strongly. We don't want to use anything except, I guess, human feces. We don't want to use any chemical fertilizers because they're not organic. I think they're ill-advised, but as I say, very sincere and very influential. They're not as influential in this country as they are in Great Britain.
And finally, a reporter asked the former president how he would explain the importance of the Donald Danforth Plant Sciences Center to his neighbors, or just research in agriculture in general.
Well, I think the Danforth Plant Sciences Research Center here is crucial now and in the future to feed the world's people, to improve the health of children, and at the same time to protect the environment. And all those responsibilities, I think, will be the major charge of the people here, and they are not incompatible.
That was former President Jimmy Carter speaking to reporters at the Donald Danforth Plant Sciences Center in St. Louis near the turn of the century. I was there in the second row listening to a farmer, a former president, that reminded me of my father. He and my older brothers had, by then, about two decades earlier, transitioned the family farms to no-till as an economic and environmental decision at first on the Hell Acres, highly erodible lands, but then to the Grand Prairie flatlands, too. Like nearly all corn and soybean farmers, they had also quickly adopted GMOs over a four-year period beginning in 1995. For me, listening to Carter then, it was about the environment, the economics, and feeding the people of the world. And as he said, all those responsibilities are not incompatible. Let's turn our attention now to the global growing regions and to see what the climate impacts might be on crops across the planet. We'll begin in South America with Mike Tenorum. He's the president and CEO at T-Storm Weather. That's tstorm.net online, based out of Naperville, Illinois. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being with us. In South America, we've been watching the Argentine weather very, very closely. The marketplace has been reacting to dry conditions there and maybe some rainfall at some point in the future. Can you tell me what your assessment of that crop and conditions and weather might be like?
Well, there's no question that it's too dry in Argentina. It started drying out 2 to 3 weeks ago, and it's certainly showing up in the data that we collect. As we move forward over the next week or two, there's not very much rain in the forecast. Yes, as you noted, there will be some storms around 10 days out, but you need about 2 to 2.5 inches of rain every 2 weeks to keep up with normal. And at this point in time, it only looks like a half of an inch to an inch is coming up, and most of that is more than 10 days out. So we need those rains to verify, then we need a lot more to follow. If that doesn't happen, there is historical precedent for dryness at this time of the year to reduce yield potential. If you look back at the recent history, we had 2 years back in 2021 and in 2022 where more than 75% of their corn and soybean production was drier than normal. This is viewing it through 30-day periods. When you look at that and it lasts all the way into the end of the month, both of those years were below trend, and that's why we're a little bit concerned about this. So yes, there is some rain on the forecast, on the horizon, I should say, around 10 days out, but we need a lot more than that, and we're going to need to see some big rains over the last week of the month.
The most northern parts of Argentina are in line with Paraguay. Southern Brazil, have these dry conditions persisted across those areas as well?
Well, they've developed over the last few weeks. Now, there it's a little bit trickier because from November into the middle of December, we would consider the weather pattern that they were in as being pretty much ideal. They were getting great rains, and they also have one of the coolest, if not the coolest, December of the last 45 years across that region. So this was a pretty ideal situation. Ever since then, though, it started to dry out. We haven't seen much rain in Rio Grande do Sul for a few weeks. And this is an area that really depends on January rainfall for first corn and soybean development. And with it being so dry over the last couple of weeks and very little rain on the horizon until also around 10 days out, you can make the argument that this is not a good thing. in the end, Todd, the thing that needs to happen to get out of this situation is we need a lot of rain 2 to 4 weeks from now. Now, we can forecast out about 2 weeks, and we can see that there are some storms on the horizon around 10 to 14 days out in all of these areas. But if those rains are only a one-off thing, and then we don't have very many storms that follow, it'll be pretty easy to argue that it's too dry. And that'll get a little bit tricky on the yield side because weather was so good leading into this period. But all in all, you just need to pay very close attention to this because this pattern is not ideal and it does need to break before the end of the month.
Are there other parts of Brazil you're watching with different stories?
Well, if you go into central and northern Brazil, which is where around half of their first corn and soybeans are produced, this area has also been having some pretty fantastic weather. But that might turn into too much of a good thing because when it dries out a lot in one part of the world, it usually turns too wet in another. And this is the area where it's turning too wet. We have all these cool fronts that are moving into central and northern Brazil, and then they're dissipating and triggering thunderstorms. These storms are going to last for at least another 10 to 14 days, and we're looking for 5 to 10 inches of rain over this period of time. Normally, they'd see around 3.5 to maybe 4.5 inches, so this is a lot of rain for them, and temperatures will be pretty cool. Now, initially, this is a good thing because you'd like to see some nice rains at this time of the year, but they do have a history of receiving too much rain late in the season, and that can reduce quality, reduce yield, and make it difficult to harvest. Now, is all that going to happen? It will if this forecast verifies and then it stays wet over the period of 2 to 4 weeks out, so late January into February. We need to keep an eye on that one as well because there's not too many signs of it breaking. And again, you know, this is a critical time of the year for them. So, Todd, there's a lot of moving parts today, and it's going to stay that way for another week or two, but everything is going to start zeroing in on these forecasts for late January and early February, because that will really determine, whether the things that we're going through now are going to matter.
I'm going to ask you one final question, and I know this is too far out for you to have a good answer, but on average, when does the monsoon stop and the dry conditions begin as we enter the safrinha or second corn crop era later in this year?
Well, generally between April 10th and April 30th, that's where things really start to fall apart. Now, once you get into May, you can still get 1 to 2 inches of rain, but most of that will be in the first part of the month. And then once you're beyond May, it's not raining very much at all. So basically, just think of it from the beginning of April through the end of May. That's where the dry season starts, and it really starts to accelerate as you move into May.
I just wanted to put that in the back of our minds as we move forward, because we'll be hearing about that in future episodes, I'm sure. Thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Todd, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Hey, you too. Mike Tenora, of course, is with T-Storm Weather. That's tstorm.net online. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media, online at willag.org. I'm Todd Gleason.